Imagine being the only black kid in class, in an entire school, and enduring the daily humiliation of also being the dumbest. I felt like everything I tried to do or say was wrong, and it got so bad that instead of responding and skipping like scratched vinyl whenever the teacher called my name, I often chose to keep quiet. It was all about limiting exposure to save face. Miss D didn't even attempt to empathize. She went straight to frustration and vented it by yelling at me, sometimes when she was leaning down, her hand on the back of my chair, her face just inches from my own. She had no idea the Pandora's box she was tearing open. Once, school was a safe harbor, the one place I knew I couldn't be hurt, but in Indiana, it morphed into my torture chamber. Miss D wanted me out of her classroom, and the administration supported her until my mother fought for me. The principal agreed to keep me enrolled if my mother signed off on time with a speech therapist and put me into group therapy with a local shrink they recommended. The psychologist's office was adjacent to a hospital, which was exactly where you'd want to put it if you were trying to make a little kid doubt himself. It was like a bad movie. The shrink set up 7 chairs in a semicircle around him, but some of the kids wouldn't or couldn't sit still. One child wore a helmet and banged his head against the wall repeatedly. Another kid stood up while the doctor was mid-sentence, walked toward a far corner of the room, and pissed in the trash can. The kid sitting next to me was the most normal person in the group, and he had set his own house on fire. I can remember staring up at the shrink on my first day, thinking, "There's no way I belong here." That experience kicked my social anxiety up several notches. My stutter was out of control. My hair started falling out, and white splotches bloomed on my dark skin. The doctor diagnosed me as an ADHD case and prescribed Ritalin, but my problems were more complex. I was suffering from toxic stress. The type of physical and emotional abuse I was exposed to has been proven to have a range of side effects on young children, because in our early years, the brain grows and develops so rapidly. If during those years, your father is an evil motherfucker hell-bent on destroying everyone in his house, stress spikes, and when those spikes occur frequently enough, you can draw a line across the peaks. That's your new baseline. It puts kids in a permanent fight-or-flight mode. Fight-or-flight can be a great tool when you're in danger because it amps you up to battle through or sprint from trouble, but it's no way to live. I'm not the type of guy to try to explain everything with science, but facts are facts. I've read that some pediatricians believe toxic stress does more damage to kids than polio or meningitis. I know firsthand that it leads to learning disabilities and social anxiety, because according to doctors, it limits language development and memory, which makes it difficult for even the most gifted student to recall what they have already learned. Looking at the long game, when kids like me grow up, they face an increased risk for clinical depression, heart disease, obesity, and cancer. Not to mention smoking, alcoholism, and drug abuse. Those raised in abusive households have an increased probability of being arrested as a juvenile by 53%. Their odds of committing a violent crime as an adult are increased by 38%. I was the poster child of that generic term we've all heard before, at-risk youth. My mother wasn't the one raising a thug. Look at the numbers and it's clear. If anyone put me on a destructive path, it was Trunis Goggins. I didn't stay in group therapy for long, and I didn't take Ritalin either. My mom picked me up after my second session, and I sat in the front seat of her car wearing a 1,000-yard stare. "Mom, I'm not going back," I said. "These boys are crazy." She agreed. But I was still a damaged kid. And while there are proven interventions on the best way to teach and manage kids who suffer from toxic stress, it's fair to say that Miss D didn't get those memos. I can't blame her for her own ignorance. The science wasn't nearly as clear in the 1980s as it is now. All I know is, Sister Catherine toiled in the trenches with the same malformed kid that Miss D dealt with, but she maintained high expectations and didn't let her frustration overwhelm her. She had the mindset of, "Look, everybody learns in a different way, and we're going to figure out how you learn." She deduced that I needed repetition, that I needed to solve the same problems over and over again in a different way to learn, and she knew that took time. Miss D was all about productivity. She was saying, "Keep up or get out." Meanwhile, I felt backed into a corner. I knew if I didn't show some improvement, I would eventually be shipped out to that special black hole for good, so I found a solution. I started cheating my ass off. Studying was hard, especially with my fucked up brain, but I was a damn good cheat. I copied friends' homework and scanned my neighbor's work during tests. I even copied the answers on the standardized tests that didn't have any impact on my grades. It worked. My rising test scores placated Miss D, and my mother stopped getting calls from school. I thought I'd solved a problem when really I was creating new ones by taking the path of least resistance. My coping mechanism confirmed that I would never learn squat at school and that I would never catch up, which pushed me closer toward a flunked-out fate. The saving grace of those early years in Brazil was that I was way too young to understand the kind of prejudice I would soon face in my new hick hometown. Whenever you're the only one of your kind, you're in danger of being pushed toward the margins, suspected and disregarded, bullied and mistreated by ignorant people. That's just the way life is, especially back then. And by the time that reality kicked me in the throat, my life had already become a full-fledged fuck-you fortune cookie. Whenever I cracked it open, I got the same message. You were born to fail. Man, David Goggins, that's a tough 8-9 years.
Yeah, it definitely did damage on me, man. It did a lot of damage on me.
We made a choice here when you were talking about, you know, we talked about maybe a half dozen or more beatdowns when we were going through it. And you zeroed in on these ones as kind of the symbolic ones that you wanted to focus on.
Right.
And I'm curious why you chose these, and was it hard to minimize? Was there ever a part of you that felt like you're actually minimizing what you went through?
Oh, I was definitely minimizing it. But I can give you a great answer on why I chose these. It was kind of like I guess the most bang for your buck. And the reason why I say that is for a young kid to physically see your mom, physically and mentally, see your mom changing. And these moments are some of the breaking moments of my mom. Like, my mom was a rock. Mm. She was a rock throughout most of this because she had to be for myself and my brother. But this moment with the whole Cub Scout scene and when I got home, that beating, I mean, it was something that she witnessed. And the look on her face, it was even worse than the beating I received. Hmm. I had just gotten the VFW award for Americanism, the Americanism VFW award. And I was thanking people up there. And I was thanking my uncle, and I was, you know, thanking the service men and women.
That was earlier summer 2018, right?
Right, right. It just happened not too long ago. And I was thanking people, and I got to my mom, and I had thousands of people staring at me, and I had delivered several speeches before in my life. And when I was trying to thank her, the flood of this memory kind of came to my mind, and I had to put my head down for the fact that I was choked up and tearing up, and it wasn't the beating I got. Her face is tattooed, is forever tattooed in my mind. And that's why I chose this one, because this one was the one that literally changed me, and it changed my mom.
The one of the Cub Scout one, or the one after the earache?
Sorry about that. There was a couple of them there. It was the one after the Cub Scout one, when my dad had me laying across the bed for about 45 minutes. Because when I walked out, usually it takes a while for kind of welts to kind of get there.
Yep.
These welts were immediate. Mm. And the black and blue, and I was trying to hide in my bedroom. And when she walked in my bedroom, I was in the bed. And when she pulled the covers out and she saw my body, that's when it all changed. And I was a part of that moment when I saw the look in her eye, and we kind of met eyes, and it was like, oh man, you don't want to ever see your mom look like that. It was just horrible.
See, this is the behind the scenes shit right here, because most people, if they just read the book, they'd feel like, okay, the arc that you're sharing in this chapter is the arc of you kind of going through the beatings. When right. In reality, you chose them because it's the arc of your mother's kind of destruction.
Exactly. Another thing we don't talk about here is as embarrassing as it is to me, I wet the bed every night in Buffalo, New York. And my mom, she would go in almost every night. So she'd wake up almost every night, and she would take my sheets and hide them and try to wash them, because my dad would beat me senselessly for wetting the bed. Cause, you know, that was all about, you know, you're not a man, you know, you peeing in the bed was not a man. But I was a big tough guy when it came to challenging my father. But at nighttime, that demon would come and roost in my head when I would sleep. And that's why I would pee in the bed every night, because I was truly afraid and I was overcoming myself to protect my mom so often. But something's got to give. And that's what gave.
Hmm. And if you could approximate how many times you were beaten by your father, or you saw your mother beaten, would it be in the hundreds?
I would say it would easily be in the hundreds. I would get a whip, and there's one time I had my bike, as we were talking about my bike here, me and my brother ride bikes. There was one time my dad told me, he was at the kitchen table, and the kitchen table had a window that looked out. And he said, "David, don't ride in the street." We all know what that means. Don't ride in the street. Roger that. I'm not going to ride in the street. So I was turning my bike around, and my bike wheel, I was in someone's driveway, and my dad could see me from the window where he was sitting at. And I was turning my bike around, and my front tire literally touched the street as I was turning around. I didn't ride in the street. I was turning around. My front tire literally grazed the actual street, and I got back on the sidewalk. When I got inside that house, he beat the shit out of me for that. So it didn't have to be a big reason. It just had to be like, if he thought that you disobeyed him, it was game on. It was game on.
Crazy, man. Well, I think it's amazing that you're sharing this much. And I know you're about to ask the readers and the listeners to kind of divulge their material here in the first challenge. And so I want to go through the challenge, and then we can talk about this challenge and kind of why you decided to challenge your readers and listeners in the book. I'll start going through it now, if you don't mind.
No, it's perfect, man. Let's do it.
Challenge number one. My bad cards arrived early and stuck around a while, but everyone gets challenged in life at some point. What was your bad hand? What kind of bullshit did you contend with growing up? Were you beaten, abused, bullied? Did you ever feel insecure? Maybe your limiting factor is that you grew up so supported and comfortable, you never pushed yourself. What are the current factors limiting your growth and success? Is someone standing in your way at work or school? Are you underappreciated and overlooked for opportunities? What are the long odds you're up against right now? Are you standing in your own way? Break out your journal. If you don't have one, buy one. Or start one on your laptop, tablet, or in the Notes app on your smartphone. And write them all out in minute detail. Don't be bland with this assignment. I showed you every piece of my dirty laundry. If you are hurt or are still in harm's way, tell the story in full. Give your pain shape. Absorb its power. Because you are about to flip that shit. You will use your story, this list of excuses, these very good reasons why you shouldn't amount to a damn thing, to fuel your ultimate success. Sounds fun, right? Yeah, it won't be. But don't worry about that yet. We'll get there. For now, just take inventory. Once you have your list, share it with whoever you want. For some, it may mean logging onto social media, posting a picture, and writing out a few lines about how your own past or present circumstances challenge you to the depth of your soul. If that's you, use the hashtags, #badhand, #can'thurtme. Otherwise, acknowledge and accept it privately. Whatever works for you. I know it's hard, but this act alone will begin to empower you to overcome. So obviously, judging on this chapter, you feel like there's power in taking inventory and owning your story. Do you want to explain this challenge and why it's so important?
Well, I realized all this stuff made me so weak, because it's how I looked at it. I looked at it that I had a jacked up foundation. I looked at it that my mom, my mom became my dad took her soul. And so as you'll read further and further on, that my mindset was controlling my destiny. When you have a poopy pants type of mentality, and this happened to me and that happened to me and woe is me, and you're kicking rocks down the street with your head down, versus looking at this, and you have to find power. You have to find power in everything negative in your life. You have to do that. So by you writing this stuff down, by you owning it, you have to, this is now a part of your life, whether you like it or not. So if that's a fact, if it's a fact that this is now a part of my life, whether I like it or not, you better go ahead and start liking it. You better find power within your own story. You better look at your story, if it's a bad one, as, hey, motherfucker, you can't hurt me. Whatever that may be, you better start owning that and flipping and start saying to yourself, yeah, there's a lot of people out here who might have had a better life than you, and they may have a little bit of a head start on life than what you had. But that should be very powerful, you know, for you or anybody else. Why is that powerful? I can tell you why. Because from that right there alone, you can start slowly catching these people, realizing where you come from, realizing the pain you endured, the suffering you endured. If you were bullied, if you have a bad, you know, bad family, whatever, you have to use this and flip the negative upside down and find positive power to fuel you forward. Stop kicking a rock down the road. Own it and make it a part of your life.
As if the survival through a trying experience, experience that, where you suffered, if you survive that right there, that's power, right? I mean, you can use it to continue to push you further.
That's right. And it's a lot more than surviving. You want to thrive. You want to be that person who was given a fucked up deck of, you know, like just a fucked up hand.
Yeah.
And the person says, okay, you know what? I have a bunch of twos and threes. There's a card game called War. And in War, what happens is you want to have the highest cards. One person flips over a card and then you flip over a card. The highest card wins. I looked at my life at this time as having a bunch of twos, threes, fours, and fives, maybe 1-10. And having that messed up hand, if you can still win the game of War, that gives you a ton of power. So it's about more than survival. It's about thriving in the situation that most people think is impossible for you to be truly amazing.
Yeah, I mean, this is what you're laying out. You had a bad hand. You were the at-risk youth. You had all the excuses. The chapter one is your list of excuses. You could have packed it in.
That's right. I should have been a statistic. You know, I should have been a statistic, which is the beauty of it all. That's the power of it all. People start seeing where I gauge my power is from the crap I lived in. There's so much power in this crap that we live in that people just don't look at it that way. But it's just a powerful thing that we can harness. If we know how to look at it the right way, we have to learn how to look at it the right way. And looking at it the right way is owning it first.
Hmm. But it would be a little while before you were able to fully start to harness it in any productive way.
100%. It's a long time coming. It's a long, long, long time coming.
And just a quick word on why you decided to include challenges in your book.
Well, the thing about it is you have to have something that you can look at and say, okay, how can I fix this part of my life? And like we talk about, everything in life is about repetition. How, you know, Sister Catherine, I thought for sure there was no way in hell I was going to ever even pass the second grade. But Sister Catherine taught me one thing. Through reps, you have to put the repetition in. And these challenges are doing exactly that. A lot of people, they do something once and they give up on it. This is something that you have to do every single day of your life. You have to hold yourself at this standard. It can't be something you do every now and then and, you know, then you get tired of it and you move on. This is a discipline. Right now, challenge one is starting the road down self-discipline. No one is going to come to help you. No one's coming to save you. All that crap is now yours. You have to develop, the key word there is self-discipline. And that's how you're going to overcome every single challenge of your life. This is challenge one that I'm giving you in my book. Tons of you have tons of challenges that you're facing every day, but it comes through repetition and self-discipline.
So you set up a kind of a protocol to be able to, and some of these challenges the reader can go back to over and over again whenever they have trouble. And the idea is to go through these challenges to develop the discipline and the mental toughness to push forward and to progress in their lives.
Exactly. Exactly. It's all about progressing. If you're not moving forward, either you're getting better or you're getting worse. If you're telling somebody, oh, I'm about the same, that means you're getting worse. These challenges are also, they're huge. And, you know, I wrote this book, you know, I'm my own hero. And what that's all about is, you know, we live our lives. We look up to so many people. We look up to, maybe you look up to a golfer or a, or a scientist or a basketball player, whatever. These people, normal people, we are all normal people. We were all, you know, someone will always let you down. Bottom line. So the whole thing about this is these challenges are here for you to be your own hero. I don't want you to look up to me. You know, hopefully somewhere in here, I'm not trying to be your hero. I am not. I want you to get these challenges, flip these challenges upside down, make these challenges work for you so you, then you can be your own hero and start seeing yourself the way, you know, you were here to be seen.
I love that. It's very much in line with the way humans have always told each other stories and finding the hero story, because within the hero story is a message for you. For you to not only tell your story, but then to give a framework for people to then do that for themselves. I think that's really empowering. And that's one of the reasons I'm super excited to be reading this book and working on it with you.
Well, I think the biggest takeaway through this whole book will always be coming back to the individual. I want the individual to always know that this isn't about me. Yeah. You are reading my life. You are reading my life. When I say can't hurt me, I want everybody out there to take that as their own. So just understand that you need to be your own hero. So that's where it all starts at, right there.
Chapter 2, Truth Hurts. Wilmoth Irving was a new beginning. Up until he met my mother and asked for her phone number, all I'd known was misery and struggle. When the money was good, our lives were defined by trauma. Once we were free of my father, we were swept under by our own PTSD-level dysfunction and poverty. Then, when I was in fourth grade, she met Wilmoth, a successful carpenter and general contractor from Indianapolis. She was attracted to his easy smile and laid-back style. There was no violence in him. He gave us permission to exhale. With him around, it felt like we had some support, like something good was finally happening to us. She laughed when they were together. Her smile was bright and real. She stood up a little straighter. He gave her pride and made her feel beautiful again. As for me, Wilmoth became as close to a healthy father figure as I've ever had. He didn't coddle me. He didn't tell me he loved me or any of that fake-ass sappy shit. But he was there. Basketball had been an obsession of mine since grade school. It was the core of my relationship with my best friend, Johnny Nichols, and Wilmoth had game. He and I hit the courts together all the time. He showed me moves, tuned up my defensive discipline, and helped me develop a jump shot. The three of us celebrated birthdays and holidays together, and the summer before eighth grade, he got down on one knee and asked my mother to make it official. Wilmoth lived in Indianapolis, and our plan was to move in with him the following summer. Though he wasn't nearly as rich as Trunis, he made a nice living, and we looked forward to city life again. Then, in 1989, the day after Christmas, everything stopped. We hadn't made the full-time move to Indy yet, and he'd spent Christmas Day with us at my grandparents' place in Brazil. The next day, he had a basketball game in his men's league, and he'd invited me to sub for one of his teammates. I was so excited I'd packed my bags 2 days early, but that morning he told me I couldn't come after all. "I'm going to keep you back here this time, little David," he said. I dropped my head and sighed. He could tell I was upset and tried to reassure me. "Your mom is going to drive up in a few days, and we can play ball then." I nodded reluctantly, but I wasn't raised to pry into the affairs of adults and knew I wasn't owed an explanation or makeup game. My mother and I watched from the front porch as he backed out of the carport, smiled, and gave us that crisp single wave of his. Then he drove off. It was the last time we'd ever see him alive. He played in his men's league game that night as planned and drove home alone to the house with the White Lions. Whenever he gave directions to friends, family, or delivery guys, that's how he always described his ranch-style house, its driveway framed by two white lion sculptures elevated on pillars. He pulled between them and into the garage, where he could enter the house directly, oblivious to the danger moving in from behind. He never did close that garage door. They'd been staking him out for hours, waiting for a window, and as he climbed out from the driver's side door, they stepped from the shadows and fired from close range. He was shot 5 times in the chest. When he dropped to the floor of his garage, the gunman stepped over him and delivered a kill shot right between his eyes. Wilmoth's father lived a few blocks away, and when he drove by the White Lions the next morning, he noticed his son's garage door open and knew something was wrong. He walked up the driveway and into the garage, where he sobbed over his dead son. Wilmoth was just 43 years old. I was still at my grandmother's house when Wilmoth's mother called moments later. She hung up and motioned me to her side to break the news. I thought about my mom. Wilmoth had been her savior. She'd been coming out of her shell, opening up, ready to believe in good things. What would this do to her? Would God ever give her a damn break? It started as a simmer, but within seconds my rage overwhelmed me. I broke free of my grandmother, punched the refrigerator, and left a dent. We drove to our place to find my mother, who was already frantic because she hadn't heard from Wilmoth. She called his house just before we arrived, and when a detective picked up the phone, it puzzled her. But she didn't expect this. How could she? We saw her confusion as my grandmother walked over, peeled the phone from her fingers, and sat her down. She didn't believe us at first. Wilmoth was a prankster, and this was just the kind of fucked-up stunt he might try to pull off. Then she remembered he'd been shot 2 months before. He told her that the guys who'd done it weren't after him, that those bullets were meant for someone else, and because they merely grazed him, she decided to forget about the whole thing. Until that moment, she never suspected that Wilmoth had some secret street life she knew nothing about, and the police never did find out exactly why he was shot and killed. The speculation was that he was involved in a shady business deal or a drug deal gone bad. My mother was still in denial when she packed a bag, but she included a dress for his funeral. When we arrived, his house was wrapped in a ribbon of yellow police tape, like a fucked-up Christmas gift. This was no prank. My mom parked, ducked under the tape, and I followed right behind her to the front door. On the way, I remember glancing to my left, trying to get a glimpse of the scene where Wilmoth had been killed. His cold blood was still pooled on the garage floor. I was a 14-year-old wandering through an active crime scene, but nobody, not my mother, not Wilmoth's family, and not even the police seemed disturbed by me being there, absorbing the heavy vibe of my would-be stepfather's murder. As fucked up as it sounds, the police allowed my mom to stay in Wilmoth's house that night. Rather than stay alone, she had her brother-in-law there, armed with his two guns in case the killers came back. I wound up in a back bedroom at Wilmoth's sister's place, a dark and spooky house a few miles away, and left alone all night. The house was furnished with one of those analog cabinet television sets with 13 channels on the dial. Only 3 channels came in static-free, and I kept it on the local news. They ran the same tape on a loop every 30 minutes. Footage of my mom and me ducking under police tape, then watching Wilmoth get wheeled on a gurney toward a waiting ambulance, a sheet over his body. It was like a horror scene. I sat there all alone, watching the same footage over and over. My mind was a broken record that kept skipping into darkness. The past had been bleak, and now our sky blue future had been blown the fuck up too. There would be no reprieve, only my familiar fucked up reality choking out all light. Each time I watched, my fear grew until it filled the room, and still, I could not stop. A few days after we buried Wilmoth, and just after the new year, I boarded a school bus in Brazil, Indiana. I was still grieving, and my head was spinning because my mother and I hadn't decided whether or not we were staying in Brazil or moving to Indianapolis as planned. We were in limbo, and she remained in a state of shock. She still hadn't cried over Wilmoth's death. Instead, she became emotionally vacant again. It was as if all the pain she'd experienced in her life resurfaced as one gaping wound she disappeared into, and there was no reaching her in that void. In the meantime, school was starting up, so I played along, looking for any shred of normal I could hang on to. But it was hard. I rode a bus to school most days, and my first day back I couldn't shake a memory I'd buried from the year before. That morning I slid into a seat above the back left tire overlooking the street as usual. When we arrived at school, the bus pulled up to the curb. We needed to wait for the ones ahead of us to move before we could get off. In the meantime, a car pulled alongside us, and a cute, overeager little boy ran toward our bus carrying a platter of cookies. The driver didn't see him. The bus jerked forward. I noticed the alarmed look on his mother's face before the sudden crush of blood splattered my window. His mother howled in horror. She wasn't among us anymore. She looked and sounded like a fierce, wounded animal as she literally pulled the hair from her head by the roots. Soon, sirens wailed in the distance and screamed closer by the second. The little boy was about 6 years old. The cookies were a present for the driver. We were all ordered off the bus, and as I walked by the tragedy, for some reason, call it human curiosity, call it the magnetic pull of dark to dark, I peeked under the bus and saw him. His head was nearly as flat as paper. His brains and blood mingled under the carriage like spent oil. For a full year, I hadn't thought of that image even once, but Wilma's death reawakened it, and now it was all I could think about. I was beyond the pale. Nothing mattered to me. I'd seen enough to know that the world was filled with human tragedy, and that it would just keep piling up in drifts until it swallowed me. Man, I remember when you first told me that story, and we were first starting to work together, and I'm like skeptical journalist guy, and even though I'd listened to your podcast and was a fan even before, you know, we'd ever hooked up,
right?
I was like, when you told me this story, I thought to myself, man, can that be true?
Right.
And it is, you know, it is true. There's newspaper reports over it, and everything that you say in this book, we've checked out 100 different ways. And I mean, it is almost impossible to believe that so much, you could have seen and witnessed so much, but it's 100% true. And I can't even imagine that scene. And the funny thing is, not funny, but like, the odd thing is you actually suppressed this memory. You lived it, you felt it, but you didn't even talk about it. You didn't brought it up to your mother. Nothing ever happened. And then after Wilma's death, a full year later, that's when it came out.
Right. So what I was really good at growing up was I realized my mom was severely damaged, and I became the man of the house. And my whole job was to show no weakness. You know, she had enough to worry about, and I didn't want her ever worrying about me. So when that little boy, I mean, it was horrible. It was just horrible to see that. And I was in seventh grade, and my little brain was just, you know, I couldn't even comprehend what I just saw. And to see a mom to that scene, to see a woman yanking her hair out of her head and just going all at it. And then I didn't know what that blood was.
Hmm.
I didn't even know that it was blood. I didn't know what had even happened, because I looked forward, and when I looked forward, all I heard was screaming. And when I looked over at the screaming, the lady was literally right across from me, and I saw little specks of, like, I didn't know it was blood then, but I saw little specks of, it looked like brown stuff on my window.
Mm.
And I just saw the woman looking down. So I got my window, and it was, you know, it was in the dead of winter. So that's the thing about it. It was literally December around the 22nd, 23rd, 24th. A year before Wilmoth died, he got murdered the day after Christmas. So it was almost a year to the day when this happened. So I got the window, and I pulled it down, and I looked down, and what I saw was this, it looked like just a flat as a pancake. It's just flat as a pancake, man. It's even hard to talk about now. And, that stuck with me forever. But the thing about it is I always would get things, put them back in my head, and move on. Just, you know, get hard. And what did it for me was I came home after seeing this little boy get run over by a bus. And once again, it was that gurney. It was on TV, and I saw that gurney, and I think watching that gurney with that little boy, and then seeing Wilmoth repeatedly in the gurney,
mm-hmm.
those two gurneys, you know, just seeing that on TV, it just sparked up this stuff, and I'll never forget it, man.
And then getting back on the bus, so it was almost like you were going into this deja vu
right.
You couldn't get out of.
Right, and it was horrible, and I literally couldn't sleep in my bed. I'll never forget, you know, after Wilmoth got murdered and all this stuff kind of, all these horrible demons came to roost in my head. I just couldn't sleep in the bed. And I remember sleeping on the floor in the fetal position for months. And there was one night, you know, I thought I was very like, what's wrong with me? So I actually went to my mom's room one night to just, you know, talk to her. And I walked in her room. I'll never forget finding her in her chair in the fetal position. And then years later, she would tell me that, you know, she couldn't sleep in her bed. Years later, so she slept in the chair, and I slept in the floor, you know, both of us in the fetal position.
I couldn't sleep in bed anymore. Neither could my mother. She slept in her armchair with the television on blast, or with a book in her hands. For a little while, I tried to curl up in bed at night, but would always wake in the fetal position on the floor. Eventually, I gave in and bedded down low to the ground. Maybe because I knew, if I could find comfort at the bottom place, there would be no more falling. We were two people in dire need of the fresh start we thought we had coming, so even without Wilmoth, we made the move to Indianapolis. My mother set me up for entry exams at Cathedral High School, a private college preparatory academy in the heart of the city. As usual, I cheated, and off a smart motherfucker, too. When my acceptance letter and class schedule came in the mail the summer before freshman year, I was looking at a full slate of AP classes. I hacked my way through, cheating and copying, and managed to make the freshman basketball team, which was one of the best freshman teams in the entire state. We had several future college players, and I started at point guard. That was a confidence boost, but not the kind I could build on because I knew I was an academic fraud. Plus, the school cost my mom way too much money, so after only 1 year at Cathedral, she pulled the plug. I started my sophomore year at North Central High School, a public school with 4,000 kids in a majority black neighborhood, and on my first day, I turned up like some preppy-ass white boy. My jeans were definitely too tight, and my collared shirt was tucked into a waistline cinched with a braided belt. The only reason I didn't get completely laughed out of the building was because I could ball. My sophomore year was all about being cool. I switched up my wardrobe, which was increasingly influenced by hip-hop culture, and hung out with gangbangers and other borderline delinquents, which meant I didn't always go to school. One day my mom came home in the middle of the day and found me sitting around our dining room table with what she described as 10 thugs. She wasn't wrong. Within a few weeks, she packed us up and moved us back to Brazil, Indiana. I enrolled at Northview High School the week of basketball tryouts, and I remember showing up at lunchtime when the cafeteria was full. There were 1,200 kids enrolled at Northview, only 5 of which were black, and the last time any of them had seen me, I looked a lot like them. Not anymore. I strolled into school that day wearing pants 5 sizes too big and sagged way down low. I also wore an oversized Chicago Bulls jacket with a backward hat, cocked to the side. Within seconds, all eyes were upon me. Teachers, students, and administrative staff stared at me like I was some exotic species. I was the first thuggish black kid many of them had seen in real life. My mere presence had stopped the music. I was the needle being dragged across vinyl, scratching a whole new rhythm. And like hip-hop itself, everybody noticed, but not everyone liked what they heard. I strutted through the scene like I gave no fucks. But that was a lie. I acted all kinds of cocky, and my entrance was brash as hell, but I felt very insecure going back there. Buffalo had been like living in a blazing inferno. My early years in Brazil were a perfect incubator for post-traumatic stress, and before I left, I was delivered a double dose of death trauma. Moving to Indianapolis had been an opportunity to escape pity and leave all that behind. Class wasn't easy for me, but I'd made friends and developed a new style. Now, coming back, I looked different enough on the outside to perpetuate an illusion that I'd changed. But in order to change, you have to work through shit, confront it, and get real. I hadn't done a shred of that hard work. I was still a dumb kid with nothing solid to lean on, and basketball tryouts ripped away any confidence I had left. When I got to the gym, they made me suit up in uniform rather than wear my more generic gym clothes. Back then, the style was getting baggy and oversized, which Chris Webber and Jalen Rose of the Fab Five would make famous at the University of Michigan. The coaches in Brazil didn't have their fingers on that pulse. They put me in the tidy-whitey version of basketball shorts, which strangled my balls, hugged my thighs super tight, and felt all kinds of wrong. I was trapped in the coach's preferred dream state, a Larry Bird time warp, which made sense because Larry Legend was basically a patron saint in Brazil and all of Indiana. In fact, his daughter went to our school. We were friends, but that didn't mean I wanted to dress like him. Then there was my etiquette. In Indianapolis, the coaches let us talk shit on the court. If I made a good move or hit a shot in your face, I talked about your mama or your girlfriend. In Indy, I'd done research on my shit-talking. I got good at it. I was the Draymond Green of my school, and it was all part of basketball culture in the city. Back in farm country, that cost me. When tryouts started, I handled the rock a bunch, and when I crossed some of the kids over and made them look bad, I let them and the coaches know. My attitude embarrassed the coaches, who were apparently ignorant that their hero, Larry Legend, was an all-time great trash talker. And it wasn't long before they took the ball out of my hands and put me in the front court, a position I'd never played before. I was uncomfortable down low and played like it. That shut me up good. Meanwhile, Johnny was dominating. My only saving grace that week was getting back with Johnny Nichols. We'd stayed close while I was away, and our marathon one-on-one battles were back on full swing. Though he was undersized, he was always a nice player, and he was one of the best on the floor during tryouts. He was draining shots, seeing the open man, and running the court. It was no surprise when he made the varsity squad, but we were both shocked that I barely made JV. I was crushed, and not because of basketball tryouts. To me, that outcome was another symptom of something else I'd been feeling. Brazil looked the same, but shit felt different this time around. Grade school had been hard academically, but even though we were one of only a few black families in town, I didn't notice or feel any palpable racism. As a teenager, I experienced it everywhere, and it wasn't because I'd become ultra-sensitive. Outright racism had always been there. Not long after moving back to Brazil, my cousin Damien and I went to a party way out in the country. We stayed out well past curfew. In fact, we were up all night long, and after daybreak, we called our grandmother for a ride home. "Excuse me?" she asked. "You disobeyed me, so you may as well start walking." "Roger that." She lived 10 miles away, down a long country road, but we joked around and enjoyed ourselves as we started to stroll. Damien lived in Indianapolis, and we were both sagging our baggy jeans and dressed in oversized starter jackets. Not exactly typical gear on Brazil's country roads. We'd walked 7 miles in a few hours when a pickup truck came bouncing down the tarmac in our direction. We edged to the side of the road to let it pass, but it slowed down. And as it crept past us, we could see 2 teenagers in the cab and a third standing in the bed of the truck. The passenger pointed and yelled through his open window, "Niggers!" We didn't overreact. We put our heads down and kept walking at the same pace until we heard that beat-to-shit truck squeal to a stop on a patch of gravel and kick up a dust storm. That's when I turned and saw the passenger, a scruffy-looking redneck, exit the cab of the truck with a pistol in his hand. He aimed it at my head as he stalked toward me. "Where the fuck you from and why the fuck you here in this fucking town?" Damien eased down the road while I locked eyes with the gunman and said nothing. He stepped within 2 feet of me. The threat of violence doesn't get much more real than that. Chills rippled my skin, but I refused to run or cower. After a few seconds, he got back in the truck and they sped off. It wasn't the first time I'd heard the word. Not long before that, I was hanging out in Pizza Hut with Johnny and a couple of girls, including a brunette I liked named Pam. She liked me too, but we'd never acted on it. We were two innocents enjoying one another's company, but when her father arrived to take her home, he caught sight of us, and when Pam saw him, her face went ghost white. He burst into the packed restaurant and stalked towards us with all eyes on him. He never addressed me. He just locked eyes with her and said, "I don't want to ever see you sitting with this nigger again." She hustled out the door after him, her face red with shame as I sat paralyzed, staring at the floor. It was the most humiliating moment of my life, and it hurt much more than the gun incident because it happened in public and the word had been spewed by a grown-ass man. I couldn't understand how or why he was filled with so much hate, and if he felt that way, how many other people in Brazil shared his point of view when they saw me walking down the street? It was the sort of riddle you didn't want to solve. They won't call on me if they can't see me. That was how I operated during my sophomore year in high school in Brazil, Indiana. I would hide out in the back rows, slump low in my chair, and sidestep my way through each and every class. Our high school made us take a foreign language that year, which was funny to me. Not because I couldn't see the value, but because I could barely read English, let alone understand Spanish. By then, after a good 8 years of cheating, my ignorance had crystallized. I kept leveling up in school, on track, but hadn't learned a damn thing. I was one of those kids who thought he was gaming the system when, the whole time, I'd been gaming myself. One morning, about halfway through the school year, I milled into Spanish class and grabbed my workbook from a back cupboard. There was technique involved in skating by. You didn't have to pay attention, but you did have to make it seem like you were. So I slumped into my seat, opened up my workbook, and fixed my gaze on the teacher who lectured from the front of the room. When I looked down at the page, the whole room went silent, at least to me. Her lips were still moving, but I couldn't hear, because my attention had narrowed on the message left for me, and me alone. We each had our own assigned workbook in that class, and my name was written in pencil at the top right corner of the title page. That's how they knew it was mine. Below that, someone had drawn an image of me in a noose. It looked rudimentary, like something out of the hangman game we used to play as kids. Below that were the words, "Nigger, we're gonna kill you." They'd misspelled it, but I had no clue. I could barely spell myself, and they'd made their fucking point. I looked around the room as my rage gathered like a typhoon until it was literally buzzing in my ears. I'm not supposed to be here, I thought to myself. I'm not supposed to be back in Brazil. I took inventory of all the incidents I'd already experienced and decided I couldn't take much more. The teacher was still talking when I rose up without warning. She called my name, but I wasn't trying to hear. I left the classroom, notebook in hand, and bolted to the principal's office. I was so enraged, I didn't even stop at the front desk. I walked right into his office and dropped the evidence on his desk. "I'm tired of this shit," I said. Kirk Freeman was the principal at that time, and to this day he still remembers looking up from his desk and seeing tears in my eyes. It wasn't some mystery why all this shit was happening in Brazil. Southern Indiana had always been a hotbed of racists, and he knew it. 4 years later, in 1995, the Ku Klux Klan would march down Brazil's main drag on Independence Day, in full hooded regalia. The KKK was active in Centerpoint, a town located not 15 minutes away, and kids from there went to our school. Some of them sat behind me in history class and told racist jokes for my benefit nearly every damn day. I wasn't expecting some investigation into who did it. More than anything, in that moment, I was looking for some compassion. And I could tell from the look in the Principal Freeman's eyes he felt bad about what I was going through, but he was at a loss. He didn't know how to help me. Instead, he examined the drawing and the message for a long beat, then raised his eyes to mine, ready to console me with his words of wisdom. "David, this is sheer ignorance," he said. "They don't even know how to spell nigger." My life had been threatened, and that was the best he could do. The loneliness I felt leaving his office is something I'll never forget. It was scary to think that there was so much hate flowing through the halls and that someone I didn't even know wanted me dead because of the color of my skin. The same question kept looping through my mind. Who the fuck is out here who hates me like this? I had no idea who my enemy was. Was it one of the rednecks from history class? Or was it somebody I thought I was cool with but who really didn't like me at all? It was one thing staring down the barrel of a gun on the street or dealing with some racist parent. At least that shit was honest. Wondering who else felt that way in my school was a different kind of unnerving, and I couldn't shake it off. Even though I had plenty of friends, all of them white, I couldn't stop seeing the hidden racism scrawled all over the walls in invisible ink, which made it extremely hard to carry the weight of being the only. It's tough, you know, for me to read this. It's almost, you know, it's almost me saying the word doesn't even feel right because, right. You know, because it's not for me to say.
Right.
And to feel it, you know, it's difficult even for me to read it. I can't even imagine you having to go through it.
Well, the thing about it is there was two different people when I was going through high school, especially in high school. No one knew about any of this stuff. It wasn't like I walked around and said, you know, woe is me, feel sorry for me. You know, I didn't tell anybody anything. I told Kurt Freeman, who was the principal, and, you know, most people didn't know, you know, like what I was going through, what I was dealing with, because I was trying to be so cool. I didn't want to be the kid that was, you know, secretly being bullied.
Mm.
Those kids aren't looked at as cool.
Right.
You know, they're looked at as, you know, you're just a little punk kid. So I was keeping up this big front, sagging my pants, wearing big coats, making up hairstyles, whatever the hell I was doing. But inside I was broken.
Yeah.
Inside, you know, I didn't want to go home and tell my mom how bad things were because, you know, she was working tons of jobs and trying to make ends meet for us. And once again, my whole thing was protect your mom. I'd rather me suffer than to see her how bad my life was.
So you couldn't share it with her. You're not going to share it with your friends because you don't want them thinking of you as some charity case.
Right.
So you had to care, and the principal couldn't help you because he just was basically intimidated by the whole thing.
Right.
And it was up to you to kind of, you ended up internalizing it.
And what's funny about all that is when I went to the principal's office, I actually just left Spanish class. I didn't ask for permission. As you read it there, I just got my book, my workbook and walked right out, walked down the hallway. And once I talked to, Kurt Freeman, I just walked back in class. Mm. You know, I think maybe the teacher asked me what was wrong. I probably lied to her. You know, I, became a really good liar at this time in my life. You know, I didn't want anybody knowing who the hell I really was. So it was just, you know, you hide all those insecurities, man. You hide everything going wrong with you because, like I said, there was two parts to David Goggins. And what I wanted people to see was I'm some tough guy that nothing could hurt me. But shit was fucking me up in a major way.
Most, if not all, minorities, women and gay people in America, know that strain of loneliness well, of walking into rooms where you are the only one of your kind. Most white men have no idea how hard it can be. I wish they did, because then they'd know how it drains you, how some days all you want to do is stay home and wallow because to go public is to be completely exposed, vulnerable to a world that tracks and judges you. At least that's how it feels. The truth is, you can't tell for sure when or if that is actually happening in a given moment. But it often feels like it, which is its own kind of mindfuck. In Brazil, I was the only everywhere I went. At my table in the cafeteria, where I chilled at lunch with Johnny and our crew, and every class I took, even in the damn basketball gym. By the end of that year, I turned 16, and my grandfather bought me a used doo-doo brown Chevy Citation. One of the first mornings I ever drove it to school, someone spray-painted the word nigger on my driver's side door. This time they spelled it correctly, and Principal Freeman was again at a loss for words. The fury that churned within me that day was indescribable, but it didn't radiate out. It broke me down from within, because I hadn't yet learned what to do or where to channel that much emotion. Was I supposed to fight everybody? I'd been suspended from school 3 times for fighting, and by now I was almost numb. Instead, I withdrew and fell into the well of black nationalism. Malcolm X became my prophet of choice. I used to come home from school and watch the same video of one of his early speeches every damn day. I was trying to find comfort somewhere, and the way he analyzed history and spun black hopelessness into rage nourished me, though most of his political and economic philosophies went over my head. It was his anger at a system made by and for white people that I connected with, because I lived in a haze of hate, trapped in my own fruitless rage and ignorance. But I wasn't Nation of Islam material. That shit took discipline, and I had none of that. Instead, by my junior year, I went out of my way to piss people off by becoming the exact stereotype racist white people loathed and feared. I wore my pants down below my ass every day. I ghetto-wired my car stereo to house speakers which filled the trunk of my Citation. I rattled windows when I cruised down Brazil's main drag, blasting Snoop's Gin and Juice. I put 3 of those shag carpet covers over my steering wheel and dangled a pair of fuzzy dice from the rear view. Every morning before school, I stared into our bathroom mirror and came up with new ways to fuck with the racists at my school. I even concocted wild hairdos. Once I gave myself a reverse part, shaving away all my hair save a thin radial line on the left side of my scalp. It wasn't that I was unpopular. I was considered the cool black kid in town. But if you'd have bothered to drill down a little deeper, you'd see that I wasn't about black culture and that my antics weren't really trying to call out racism. I wasn't about anything at all. Everything I did was to get a reaction out of the people who hated me most, because everyone's opinion of me mattered to me, and that's a shallow way to live. I was full of pain, had no real purpose, and if you were watching from afar, it would have looked like I'd given up on any chance of success, that I was heading for disaster. But I hadn't let go of all hope. I had one more dream left. I wanted to join the Air Force. My grandfather had been a cook in the Air Force for 37 years, and he was so proud of his service that even after he retired, he'd wear his dress uniform to church on Sundays and his workaday uniform midweek just to sit on the damn porch. That level of pride inspired me to join the Civil Air Patrol, the civilian auxiliary of the Air Force. We met once a week, marched in formation, and learned about the various jobs available in the Air Force from officers, which is how I became fascinated with pararescue, the guys who jump out of airplanes to pull downed pilots out of harm's way. I attended a week-long course during the summer before my freshman year called PJOC, the Pararescue Jump Orientation Course. As usual, I was the only. One day, a pararescueman named Scott Guerin came to speak, and he had a motherfucker of a story to tell. During a standard exercise on a high-altitude jump from 13,000 feet, Guerin deployed his chute with another skydiver right above him. That wasn't out of the ordinary. He had the right of way, and per his training, he'd waved off the other jumper. Except the guy didn't see him, which placed Guerin in grave danger, because the jumper above him was still mid-freefall, hurtling through the air at over 120 miles per hour. He went into a cannonball, hoping to avoid clipping Guerin, but it didn't work. Guerin had no clue what was coming when his teammate flew through his canopy, collapsing it on contact, and slammed into Guerin's face with his knees. Guerin was knocked unconscious instantly and wobbled into another freefall, his crushed chute creating very little drag. The other skydiver was able to deploy his chute and survive with minor injuries. Guerin didn't really land. He bounced like a flat basketball three times, but because he'd been unconscious, his body was limp, and he didn't come apart despite crashing into the ground at 100 miles per hour. He died twice on the operating table, but the ER docs brought him back to life. When he woke in a hospital bed, they said he wouldn't make a full recovery and would never be a pararescueman again. 18 months later, he defied medical odds, made that full recovery, and was back on the job he loved. David. Scott Guerin.
Yeah, this guy right here was a fucking badass, especially for a young kid who was just looking for anything to sink his hands in that gave me some hope. So I was at this PGOC camp, and basically how he was introduced was this guy named Bill Burton, who's now dead. He was a pararescueman also. Bill Burton gave this guy an introduction. He said, "Hey, I want you all to, you know, kind of stand up and put your hands together for Scott Guerin." And when this guy came out, when Scott came out, the first thing I noticed was his throat. His throat had been cut open to get an open airway from his accident. So I will get to that in a little bit. But when Scott came out, he sounded just like Clint Eastwood, you know, because, you know, they had messed up his throat so bad, and he was telling this story. And so he went on and went on telling the story. So for 7 days, man, I would literally sit outside my tent, and this guy would come out of his little hut, and he would do push-ups and sit-ups and flutter kicks all day long. So I became obsessed with Scott Guerin.
Did he look fucked up aside from his throat?
No, he didn't look fucked up at all. He looked like a daggone Greek god. And so I became obsessed with Scott Guerin. So we leave the pararescue or the PGOC training, and I go back home, and I keep thinking about this guy. And this is before, you know, Google and all that shit where you could find somebody. So we had no money. So I go on this hunt for Scott Guerin. And I'm literally Googling, or not Googling, but calling all these Air Force bases. Hey, are there any pararescuemen there? No. So there's very few bases that have pararescuemen. So I finally locate a base, and I'm like, hey, pararescueman, yes. So then I'm tied into now all the PJs, all the pararescuemen. So I start getting a little bit of traction. So long story short, man, I spent over $500 on a phone bill trying to track this guy down.
You were wearing out 411, huh?
Oh my God. It was unbelievable. So I tracked the guy down, and so I leave him a message. And he actually calls me, but my mom answers the phone. And she's like, oh my God, like my son's gonna lose his mind. And he's like, who the hell is your son? And my mom's like, he was like the only black guy in PJ training, in pararescue training. So, you know, to cut to the chase, I go stay with this guy for like 2 weeks. So I'm like begging him, can I please come stay with you? Now, I know the guy for a week. We never had any interaction. I'm begging this guy to come live with him for a week. So he was a scuba instructor in Key West, Florida, at the Special Forces Scuba School. So I go down and stay with him for 2 weeks. And while I'm down there, he's telling me the stories about how this kind of parachute accident happened. So his parachute accident, it's all true how it went down. But the day before the parachute accident, he was actually teaching two Navy SEALs who were not medics. He was teaching these two guys on how to cut the throat to open up an airway if something happened. So Scott and these guys go for a parachute jump. The guy goes through his parachute, knocks Scott unconscious, as you all have just heard. He hit the ground, bounced twice, and the Navy SEALs that he just taught the day before, they land on the ground, go over to Scott and actually open his airway. So if Scott didn't teach these guys how to open up an airway, Scott would be dead today.
That's amazing.
It's truly amazing.
That's an amazing story. And that's why you audiobook listeners are stoked, because you are getting the annotated version of this.